Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Welcome back to a St. Patrick's Day edition of the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by my Irish compatriot, Steve O apostrophe Sello, son. Nick, how are you, my friend?
Oh, Terry, I'm doing just fine. How are you in this fine Sunday afternoon?
I'm breaking out of dry January is what I'm doing.
Oh, I love to hear that. I broke out of dry January on, I think, January 5th, potentially.
No, don't mislead our listeners like that. We got the update in early February. But, Nick, that's not the most substantial thing that happened to you this weekend. You survived another ordeal.
Terry, a lot of lacrosse being played this weekend. We're going to talk into a lot of the level. The best lacrosse that was played this weekend was at Mountain View Park in Boise, Idaho, with the, it's not even a formal pickup league. It's just, I think, a massive group chat that I refuse to be a part of. Just a bunch of dudes getting together in a park and playing lacrosse. And I was like, okay, what is this going to be, five people? I show up, about 36 dudes showing up on a Sunday to run sixes playing lacrosse in Boise, Idaho, ranging from the 5'5", 290 pounds to the 6'5", about 86 pound. And every body type, every skill level, everybody come one, come all. And what's funny is I wore Bayhawk stuff and I got so many questions of like, that's a cool helmet. What's that? And I'm like, oh, it's this team called the Bayhawks. And they're like, what is that? And I'm like, oh, yes, this is fantastic. And then I missed a shot. And then somebody from the sidelines yells, is that why you got cut from the Redwoods? Everybody laughed. And then like three dudes came up to me afterwards like, yo, did you really play for the Redwoods? And I'm like, nah, like it's just this big inside joke, you know, is what it is. Terry, this is how the sport was meant to be played. It was isolation dodges into quadruple teams, and there was no other offensive sets. It was, hey, let's clear the ball. The goalie almost broke a window on the house that shouldn't have been in consideration for being broken. Couple good players. There's an old Robert Morris guy that plays. There's the variants. But none of the players that like actually know what they're doing are going out there and like trying to run sets. They're like, okay, I'm trying behind the back, between the legs. Terry, it was a beautiful lacrosse experience. And I actually just texted my buddy Dakota and I was like, that's probably the most fun I've had playing lacrosse in the last five-ish years. Too many times it's serious. Nobody was hacking. And it was just spraying piss missiles all over the field. Ran out of balls about halfway through and had to do a big ball hunt. It was fantastic. 10 out of 10, no notes. When was the last time you played lacrosse, Terry?
So in that context, 15 years. In a very different but kind of equivalent context. So about this time last year, the Inside Lacrosse staff, and there are like six or seven of us that are still like, first of all, close enough to where our office actually is. And second of all, interested in playing and not like on negative two ACLs to the point where it's feasible. So we started playing fiddlestick, like two on two, three on two, or three on three in a half court basketball gym that's in like this gym that we have access to by virtue of where our office is. I am not exaggerating, like a 90 minute run from 7 to 8:30 a.m. on a Tuesday morning, just playing fiddlestick, no pads, like rotating goalie on a three by goal is, it reignited it. So I'm going to make two very different, equivalently bold and totally earnest comments. It reignited my love for the game in a way that I didn't think was possible. It actually improved and evolved the quality of my analysis in a way that I would never have been able to predict. Like I had this conversation with somebody last week where I was just like, every year it kind of feels like I gravitate toward this new or different element of like how sports are and how the game unfolds and whatever. So like, for instance, like
offensive, you know, efficiency is your thing this year.
Efficiency? Efficiency, whatever, is always my thing.
Yeah.
No. Anyways, this year, I'll get to my thing here. I'll get to my thing this year in a second. And actually, I really want to hear it because it kind of applies to the story that you just told. But like, for example, in prior years, one year I was really focused on fatigue. I was just like, for whatever reason, I was like, I'm going to, because when you're sitting in a press box and you don't play sports, like, you don't, you don't do a good enough job of applying how much a player being tired at the end of a game versus the beginning of a game, like, affects their performance, right? So 1 year I was just like, I really want to pay attention to how fatigued I think guys are and how that's actually manifesting in the game. Other years, like, I'm kind of like not an injury guy. There are some people who I think, like, if it like, you might be the MVP of the league, but if you're injured, that accounts for 28% reduction in performance, and that's the reason that you're struggling. I think that there's some, you know, conversation around Russell Melendez this year. Is he actually injured even though he's playing in every game, and that's accounting for why he isn't as productive as he was last year? Those are two examples of things that I've focused on equivalently in the past. This year, what I'm really focused on is effectively, like, will to get to the cage and how relative it is to how good you are as a player. Basically, this really stems from watching Peyton Cormier be so good early in the season and struggling to understand why there aren't just more 240-pounders with buttery hands that can just do what they want. You know what I mean? It doesn't feel like that is the market inefficiency for offensive players, because it's like, it was like Ian Dingman and then like Will Yeatman and then Peyton Cormier, or Cody Jameson was in there in the, you know what I mean? But like, we don't have the guy who just uses his like mass and girth to get to dangerous spots and then shoot through two defenders to the extent that it feels like we should. Matt Rambo, obviously he's probably like the best example of this that I didn't bring up. Chris Cloutier as well. But it just feels like
barrel.
This world doesn't suffer from a lack of enormous dudes. And yet the game of lacrosse tends to be dominated by guys who are either 6'2", 205 pounds, or 5'10", 180 pounds, or smaller. Why is there no, you know, 5'10", 200 to 6'2", 245 pounder, like, with regularity, right? Like, there should just be a conveyor belt of this guy. And my point is that, like, it's because they just decide, like, I'm going to the goal now, and you are not physically strong enough, and the rules are not disposed for you to be able to let me, to stop me from getting there.
And it's fascinating seeing this play out as a part of, like, a big thing of what I'm going to talk about today with all the games is, like, roster depth and, like, you know, weapons. And we constantly go back to that well because I think it's one of the best ways to analyze a team. Like, what are the dangerous weapons? And even using Classic, I'm going to go right back to the Notre Dame well, where it's like you have Eric Dobson, you have Faison, and then you have the Kavanaughs. And Dobson, and even reflecting on my time, where it was essentially like me and Sergio were the guys where it was like, they're coming out of the box, good luck stopping them when they have a full head of steam. If Sergio and I were on the crease, I'm shitting my pants and dropping the ball if anybody is coming to feed me. And as it relates to that entire conversation and kind of going back to that earlier point, like the little fiddlestick three by and the little things that I think the coaches might be forgetting when I think to the spring breaks that we had at Notre Dame. I think I developed as a player more in spring breaks a lot of times than I did at practice, because you're so sick of lacrosse. All your friends are in Punta Cana, you know, doing jello shots, whatever. And we're sitting there after practice going like, what can we do? And we just started playing three by, and we started playing with tennis balls. And like that type of development, I feel, often gets lost for the rigid structure of like, Dobson, be a strong lefty, dodge, take somebody's head off and shoot at 150 miles an hour. To the point where, you know, obviously I'm not a college coach, but I think it'd be fun to run this game of, hey, Coach Corrigan, fall ball should be three by for 50% of the time with tennis balls and see what happens from that. I don't know if that's like totally relevant to your point or where you were going, but I always talk about like the three by aspect of it being one of the best way to gamify skill development. And I think it's one of the greatest Trojan horses in the entire sport of lacrosse.
There's no question about that. And that is definitely inherent to the point that I was making. But the other point that I was making is way more relevant to the Punta Cana jello shots comment. And just a quick aside before we have to get to the games, because I got a criticism about how stupid podcasters ramble for 10 minutes before they actually get to whatever the topic that is that they're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. Whoever that
couldn't
was,
be
shut
us.
Up.
Did you see the story last week about the Southern Miss quarterback who got arrested twice in 30 minutes for alcohol
possession? Chad Kelly?
Swag Kelly was not it. I think he's above age. No, this is Swag Kelly part two. Keep doing you, son. That's all I got to say about that.
Swag Kelly Jr. He actually goes by Swagger Kelly. He's formalized his name. Okay, let's talk some lacrosse. Because this weekend, so I'm at that time of year where almost the first thing I do, almost at any point throughout the weekend, like, you know, we can recap St. Patty's Day, like I was on a hike and doing this. There wasn't a time where I didn't have the IL scoreboard just like up on my phone. It's my favorite thing to go check. It's my favorite thing without having watched the games yet to just create narratives. And so many narratives could be created. This was the weekend of close games. So I went and did a tally as Terry pours a nice Guinness Lager into his pint glass at a girl. It was 10 games within a 2-goal margin of each other. So we're not going to talk about a significant amount of great games this weekend. So if this was your team,
let me clean that up for you. What you're trying to say is there are a significant amount of good games that we are not going to get to.
That we are not going to get to because yes. We're respectful of your time and we would never ramble. So just to preface this, hey, if your team got that big overtime win and we don't touch on it, join the club. There's 9 other teams that had a close game and a win or a loss. We have to start with, I saw a tweet that you posted, game of the year potential. I don't honestly know how you can beat it because this game had everything. Cornell to kick off Ivy League weekend in a absolute textbook definition of the overused word thriller. Cornell 15, Princeton 14. And I want to say that I wanted to start with Navy Hopkins, but Terry, you're a communist, I'm a patriot, we're fine by that. And this fits right into the mold that we've been talking about this year where no lead is safe and no comeback is insurmountable. And this applies to both teams somehow.
It's
so, like, to an extent, if you didn't watch this game, do yourself a favor, go back and watch it. It was ultimately decided by a long pole transition goal after a turnover with, I think it was like 11 seconds left, to the point where as I saw that turnover happen, I was like, okay, so I guess we get some bonus lacrosse. Nope. So Matt Dooley gets to play hero ball, but to put it more in context of the game, Cornell had ridiculous contributions from all over the roster, 9 players scoring goals. Princeton's Tucker Wade had 4. But these runs, Terry, I can't say enough about them. Cornell was up 8-2 after a 7-0 run. Princeton immediately followed that up by going on a 10-0 run to make it 12-8. Cornell responded to that by going on a 4-0 run, which tied it at 12. And this is just a thing of beauty. This is why we play the game. This is why we love sports. Cornell Princeton.
So my weekend was incredible. I headed up to New Haven on Saturday morning, hit Harvard-Yale, which is what we're going to get to next. On my way back, jumped off the train. It was moving. Hero ball. Stayed at New Brunswick. Walked from my hotel to Culver versus St. Anthony's this morning, which was played at Rutgers practice facility. And then my boy Dan Aber and I hightailed it out of Rutgers and made it to Princeton. Nick, I'm not exaggerating. It was 8-2 when I walked in the door. And then all of a sudden, it was 12-8. It was unbelievable. And you're right. Tucker Wade was incredible. I mean, so he played on Princeton's... Well, he got into the game. I don't know if he was on their first line, but he was in their top two lines in their prior game. But prior to that, he hadn't really been involved. Freshman, didn't play his senior year at Bullis. Spent his junior year in Australia, kind of like a gap year type situation. And then prior to that was COVID. So it has legitimately been like 5 years since Tucker Wade has played like normal scholastic lacrosse. And the kid goes out and drops 4 goals in what's effectively the second game that he's played in 5 years. Unbelievable. But it's so much more than that because on Cornell's side, they're coming off of a shellacking against Penn State, which, you know, is just in and of itself. I mean, we talked about that game pretty extensively and it was just one of those games that makes you wonder, like, is the rudder on this ship broken? Like, can it be fixed and can they come back? They start a new goalie. Ryan Goldstein, who's a freshman, who when I visited their practice in the fall, everybody was like, yeah, I mean, he's Michael Long. Michael Long didn't practice in the fall because of injury, and they were just like, he's doing the best impersonation of him that we can imagine. And he didn't really contribute very much because he got hurt early in the spring, and so, you know, he's kind of like working his way back into health. So he didn't start, but he like basically became a starter after the third or fourth possession. And that, you know, the contributions don't end there, and we'll get to Matt Dooley in a second. But yeah, I mean, it's just like a crazy, crazy game in that respect. Andrew McMeekin, who is Princeton's faceoff guy, you know, Princeton had a really rough go facing off in an early season loss and then rebounded a little bit on that North Carolina trip. They got the better of Cornell, who's playing without Jack Haskaden. And you could feel it during that run as they started to separate. In the third quarter, Princeton forgot how to clear. And middle of the field is something that we've talked about a ton. I think they ended up failing 7 clears on the day, maybe 8. And I think that Cornell scored on 5 of those failed clears. Like, just an unbelievable shoot-yourself-in-the-foot performance in that respect. But ultimately, yeah, it was a 14-14 game. Princeton timeout, coming out 30 seconds. I positioned myself above the Princeton fans, top row of the stands, in order to be able to get their reaction if Princeton was going to score that game-winning goal. All of a sudden, there's a turnover at the top of the box. Oops. And one of the things about Princeton, and I noticed this throughout the game, and then Dan Kaplan was talking about it on our company chat during the game as well, is that Jim Mitchell, right now, I think he's probably like the most highly regarded offensive coordinator mind in the sport, by virtue of a combination of what he's done in the last couple of years at Princeton and also what he did in the PLL last year. And, you know, it's hard. Lacrosse is not a scripted game, right? Like, you can't draw plays the way a football offensive coordinator can and create outcomes that demonstrate your brilliance. Like, your skill manifests in your player's feel. That's the term that I use right now. I think it's very in vogue, is that, like, developing feel, which is a combination for... it's a combination of sense for like time and score, right? Like, you got to know situations, especially in a shot clock era when you're running up against low clock situations in ways that you weren't before the shot clock. You got to understand your teammates like dangerous shooting spots. And then you got to understand like how you're going to get to those looks. One of the things that Princeton does really, really well is they effectively flip the field. They put their middies pretty low and they put their attackmen up top. And that develops a lot of space for their attackmen. And you see that a lot. We're going to talk to Andy Shea here, hopefully, in a second. And maybe I can get him to use the word top-heavy. And it's one of his rules. You cannot be top-heavy. Well, Princeton is kind of top-heavy a lot if they don't want their attackmen to basically transition back. And that's what we saw here. Coulter Mackesy doesn't cross the midline. All of a sudden, Matt Dooley is in free space. Nobody slides to him. And you get a long pull goal. Game winner, 1.9 seconds left on the clock. It was unbelievable. And yeah, the game of the year component of it is not just about the runs, which it absolutely was. It is not just about the unexpected performances, which we've already gone over and they were totally there. It's not just about the incredibly dramatic finish. There's also the narrative component to it. George Boyardee died on this day 20 years ago. Cornell has embraced his legacy to the point where it is synonymous with who they are. Like, it is bad enough to lose a game in which you led by 6 goals against your rival. By the way, we didn't talk about this. Like, the Ivy League just decided to flip their schedule to the point where now we have 2 rivalry games kicking off Ivy League play. So to lose a game like that, especially it would have obviously been in the last second, when you're honoring the legacy of this player's death who has meant so much for what you are. I mean, again, like, we were leaving because we had to get home to record this podcast, and we were driving through the Cornell tailgate post game. Chris Long does this on his podcast every week after the NFL weekend. They award like best flight home, and we don't really have that. So I've always thought about, like, we should do that. It would be a cool like little feature. It's not really the same for us. Basically, best road victory in terms of the celebration going home. And Abram and I were driving through, and I know a couple of the Cornell parents, and I was just looking at them, and I was like, these people, I mean, they have gone to the Final Four, right? Like, they've gone to the national championship game. They have won a semifinal game. I went to that tailgate. I don't think that was as good as this one was. It was incredible, and an absolutely incredible game.
I mean, so many different places to take this, but what I would have given to be at that tailgate and just see the vibes and see everything. And let's not forget that it's nice out for the first time in a while. So, like, spring fever's hitting.
Not to mention, the spring is even, it's hitting even harder because this is hysterical and you're either going to love it or hate it. Cornell flag at the top of the flagpole, Canadian flag right beneath it. How many Molsons? We're coming out of those coolers.
One too many. One Molson at a tailgate is one too many for my blood. And by the way, I mean that in the sense that, hey, if you think you're a heavyweight, go up to Canada, get put under 15 tables in a row. So that had to be all time.
Did you ever play with a Canadian at Notre Dame? Was there ever a Canadian on the roster while you were there?
Kyle Trolley.
Kyle Trolley was there when you were there. Absolute stud.
He was one of the fastest players, greasy stick skills. And we just didn't know how to use him. So every time I was playing with him, I'm like, oh, I'll make this cut, which makes sense. And he's like, ah, you know, don't go that way, go this way. And I'm like, I don't even know what you're talking. How would you make that pass? And he's like, oh, I just backhand it. And I'm like, no, the coach will get mad at us. Because I didn't understand, like, what actually Canadians could do. So Kyle Trolley, you're one of my favorite guys. I saw him at Adam Goins' wedding this past summer. He's awesome. But that Princeton point about how they are generally top-heavy is a fascinating one, because very few times do you get to watch a team. And I, in the same way that, like, you can kind of just see what offensive coordinators attempt to do throughout the game, and a lot of it is very similar. You know, over the however many years lacrosse has been played and televised, most of the games, it's like, okay, so now they're in a 2-3-1. Now they're in a 1-4-1. Now they're running a mumbo. And it's kind of fun to, like, pick apart from, like, a if I'm like, I put my defensive coordinator hat on to watch a game, it's kind of fun to just, like, pretend to do scouting reports sometimes. That's how I get through having to watch Merrimack games with my girlfriend. And Princeton's the nightmare. And it's such a great double-edged sword that it's a nightmare to guard. Not only, it's like, it's almost like preparing for the triple option. Okay, I'm a close defenseman. I'm playing at X. I'm comfortable here. Now I have to guard offensive players that I'm trying to play up top. And even in that player mindset, if I'm top left or top right as a short stick D midi, I'm comfortable. As soon as I get inverted, I cry, fill up my diaper, call my mom, and want to ride home. So I love that Princeton's offense inverts, like, almost, it's almost like a reverse invert in a sense. But boy, are they going to have to figure out a way to prevent those clears, rides, those turnovers are so much more brutal when you can't get back. Obviously, that was the ending game, but I think Princeton's one of the more fascinating teams to watch in general.
You're right. And Nate Kibiri, I mean, you talked last week about Michael Leo and how whenever he has the ball, it's just an electric factory. Nate Kibiri's low to highs and the way in which they punish the underside of the pipe is just so outrageous. But we also, I mentioned some of the new contributors, and I left out AJ Nikolic, who's a freshman from Philly, number 16 for Cornell, who I think finished with three, but who knows? I've lost track of the stats. That kid dodges hard, man. Like, just the conveyor belt of Cornell midfielders who know how to get to the middle of the field and make things happen. There were so many performances in this game where I was just like, that kid's good. That kid's good. That kid's good. I mean, it was incredible. It was fun to watch. Yeah, man. I'm just gonna start gushing. So let's move on because I don't really have anything else to say. I think we've covered it.
Maybe we have to come up with a new statistic to track. And it's like, I don't know. I don't know if we'll have to edit this out, but like, how big are this kid's balls when he's dodging? Like, all right. And he has, it's like, oh, he's on grapefruit status. Like,
I'm pretty sure if. I mean, yeah, well, first of all, I think that you obviously have carte blanche to talk about this in a medical way, in ways that most people don't. So that's good. I mean,
which we are going to bring up later in the episode, which just prepare for that.
I have never been as excited for what you just teased as what you just teased. Is this what you texted me about last night when you said I have updates?
No.
My God. I can't even believe it. This is what a podcast. What a podcast we're doing right here.
I'm pumped. Okay, so we'll move on.
But what I was going to say is that I think as long as you use the word cojones, you can just say whatever you want. It doesn't even matter. You can just use the most vulgar examples after that. But as long as you use the term in Spanish, you're total carte blanche, which is Not a Spanish term. That's a French term. But yes.
Yeah.
Carte blanche to talk about cojones, and you're good to go.
Okay. We'll do a cojones factor for players who dodge with large cojones.
Correct.
I have funny stories when we stop recording as well. So, moving on to the next game, and it was such a weird weekend because I almost felt like I was in late April with the Ivy League matchups in particular. So, you just talked about how, and we talked about it last week with Coach Byrne, about how the rivalries are flipped. I'm used to watching Harvard-Yale and getting excited about it in April, but here we are, mid-March, and the Ivy League kickoff not only has Cornell-Princeton, but it has Yale-Harvard. And another unbelievable game. And just sticking with that theme of, like, no lead is safe. I'm going to go out on a bit of a limb and say that Harvard pretty much outplayed Yale in almost every factor except for the critical face-off. One of the best names in the entire sport, Machado Rodriguez. That's just a badass name. He's got some cojones for sure. The game started where he won a face-off, and it was kind of like, pass it to the wing, back up top to the pole, goal. 10 seconds in, before he was even off the field, they had scored a goal. And I feel like if you could isolate one play that would represent the rest of the game and have the biggest impact, it was the first 10 seconds of this game. So he not only dominated from the X, but there's always that, especially as I call box games, I'm like, oh, you know, Baptiste is going against Withers and there's a 30-second lockup and then somebody exits and then it's an immediate loose ball scrum. That's a face-off win for somebody, but it's worthless, as a face-off win. He was dominating, winning it forward, and I think he had 20 ground balls on the game, which...
That's correct.
To not only win clamps and make exits, but to maintain possession and to do it so consistently forward, ultimately ended up being the complete X factor. And so he went 24 for 34. And Harvard, as we just talked about, very, very tough team to kill. Yale was up 13-6 at halftime. And Harvard responds with a 5-1 third quarter, which cut the lead to 2. And I feel like, in a way, this was a tale of two offenses as well. Yale's depth versus Harvard's stars. Brandow had 0 goals and had 8 points on the day. I'll let you at home do the math on how many assists he had. 8. Cool was a big beneficiary. He was hot with 4 goals on the day. and they had 7 other goal scorers. Whereas Harvard's Sam King and Teddy Malone had 5 goals apiece and did most of the heavy lifting. And it felt weird that this was on opening Ivy League play. But both teams kind of had positives to take away from it. And this was another fantastic Ivy League game.
Yeah. So a couple things here before I'm not going to let you get off the hook, because there was one other Harvard performance that we got a shout out, which is your boy Logan Ip, Hong Kong national team player from the summer that I know you called like half of his games. I thought he played really well as well. But you're right. And, you know, talking to Jerry Byrne before the game, he isolated 2 things that he felt like were going to be more significant in the outcome than others. A, rebounds, and B, secondary contributors. And certainly Yale's depth, which manifested not just in the number of guys who produced, but also the way in which they responded to injury, particularly losing Jack Stuzan, the All-American LSM, midway through the game, was a reflection of what this team has been to this point. And that is a reflection, I think, of the program and the way that it's developed. Concurrently, Harvard now, I think, is down 3 of their top 6 midfielders, and they, you know, struggled to find some of that secondary scoring. But at the same time, I think that the only aspect that you left out in terms of your breakdown was the role that extra man played in giving them the spark that allowed them to get back in the game. So because of the role of the faceoff and how consistent Yale was in winning that, the penalty right before halftime, so Harvard scores to make it 13-6. It kind of ended a long Yale run where they separated after what was like a relatively close game through the first, I don't know, let's say 12 to 17 minutes. And then it erased the faceoff to start the third quarter. Harvard gets the ball. They score on that extra man. And then they scored 2 more extra man goals over the course of the third quarter. And then that set up what ultimately ended up being a 2-goal game, then a 4-goal game, and then a 2-goal game. And then Patrick Hackler scored what in a normal week would be like a play of the week nominee. It was a 70-yard goal against a 10-man ride that didn't bounce before it went in. It was an exceptional play. And it was a good capstone to what was a great game. But there's somebody that can talk about it a lot better than we can, and he just joined us. Yale head coach Andy Shea. What's going on, brother?
Hey, guys. How you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm trying to withhold my cough here.
I apologize. So you were sick during the Denver game. Are you still carrying the same illness?
2 weeks. Yeah, it's 2 weeks. It's been brutal.
It's brutal.
I think I just get old and I don't recover like I used to, maybe. I don't know. I don't heal.
I should tell you that, and we don't endorse drinking on this podcast, but we do drink on this podcast. And if you've ever been to Ireland, and specifically St. James Gate, the Guinness Brewing Factory, they tell you it's for your health. So I prescribe you one Guinness on St. Patrick's Day in order to try to cure that cough.
We use the one can of Guinness in the house to make corned beef, so that's gone. So,
well, and I'm telling you, if you try to go out and get one from the store, it's all sold out, so you're screwed.
Okay.
Yeah. How was the corned beef? Salty?
It was good. Flaky? Well, my wife was out, so I had the responsibility of adding the cabbage.
And then,
yeah, well, there wasn't enough room, so I basically screwed everything up. So it was... I'm the only one in the house that's 100% Irish, and I screwed up the Irish meal. So, oh well.
Andy, I've already asked you what you ascribe the outcome to, and you said you felt like you outlasted him. How important is it to feel like that, especially 24 hours later, right? Just because it says a lot about who your team is. And not only that, but also down five starters.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that, you know, for us, we're trying to figure out, are we in, what kind of shape are we in right now? And talking to my strength coach, you know, kind of what happened in the second half. I think the penalties had a big, was a big factor. That's how they got back in the Bucknell game too. So, you know, just that morning I was watching those cuts again, and I'm like, I noticed that was what, you know, allowed them to open the door. So I was just hoping that it wouldn't happen. And of course we got the 2-minute unreleasable, and, you know, I think we had a potential to win those man down faceoffs, but the ball just kind of wasn't able to get secured, and we had a couple mistakes, and, you know, next thing you know, it's a ball game. So, you know, I don't know if we got tired. I don't know if the pace was too much in the first half. You know, we had 35 shots in the first half. I couldn't believe it. So, but, you know, I think that as you play in these games, you get a little bit more savvy and a little bit older. And, you know, with our injuries, we're playing a lot of younger guys and, you know, a lot of new guys. So, you know, I think that you got to learn to win games like that, hopefully.
Well, and what's kind of fascinating to me is, like, when you plug in a young guy, and I'd love to get your perspective on this, oftentimes they're just either fitting a role within the offense, or the offense can kind of mold around what these younger guys who might not have much experience with are bringing to the table. So kind of on that spectrum, are the young guys kind of just contributing to an already pre-existing offense, or has the offense kind of had to shift from the first game of the season to a more flowing, hey, we're going to have new guys in here and we kind of have to play to their strengths,
yeah,
because the X's and O's of game one is going to have to change until, you know, obviously present day.
You know, I think that these young guys that we've kind of injected in the lineup are a little surprised that we need them to put up points too. You know, they're not just, you know, carrying the ball for a little bit and moving it to Brandow and letting him do it. So, you know, Cole Cashin is a guy that we expect to, you know, put up points in every game he's played in. He's kind of held back. Like, he doesn't know that it's his role that he has to do it. So he had a big goal and a big assist in the game. And, you know, we're excited that he was able to kind of crack that. Peter Moynihan is another one. He's been, you know, we need him to do a little bit more, and we kind of explained it to him, like, listen, man, I don't care that you're a freshman. We need you to, you know, you've got a good shot, you got to take it, and you got to put points on the board. So they've been great.
Well, and I kind of have like I fall back to any time young guys are more or less forced into the roster. It's very easy for me to sit back and say that that's going to pay off in the long run. So I'd kind of like to get your perspective on the depth of Yale's offense, which is something that we were talking about kind of just before you joined. Is this going to pay off, you know, over the course of the season, over the course of the next 4 years? Because I always say that, and I think it's a convenient thing for me to say. So I'd love your perspective on that.
I mean, I hope it is. You know, I think if you told me that 5 games into the season, you're going to lose all these guys and you're going to have to play, you know, this kid and this kid and this kid that just showed up on your campus. You know, play a kid that the year before that we tried to put out there in certain games and couldn't do it. Kid named David Anderson that, you know, had opportunities last year and wasn't nearly as effective this year. You know, position switched a bunch of guys. So my hope is that it pays off. You can probably lean on that a little bit too much and expect guys to take a leap, you know, the next year. You know, I would love to be in a situation where nobody gets hurt and next year I got, you know, too many guys to play, but you know, we'll see. We're still down a bunch. We really can't scrimmage that much in practice right now. It's kind of crazy with the number of guys that are out.
But God, that's wild.
Yeah, it's you know, with a COVID inflated roster too. I mean, we got started with 51 guys this year, so it makes it tricky. You know, you got to be a little bit, you know, you got to be intelligent with what you're doing in practice. And you know, the other night we practiced, you know, we're like, all right, we're going to scrimmage at the end. And, you know, first shift, one of our middies blows out his knee. So it was awful. But it's like, oh, there's another one. And then Jack Stuzan goes down in the game. It's like, when's this going to stop? So hopefully he'll be back. You know, we'll see. Hopefully he's back for Cornell.
Yeah. Well, all the best. Obviously wish everybody a speedy recovery. Yourself with this flu bug included. And final question from me is, how weird was it to play against Harvard this early in the season? I was just talking about how I usually expect this matchup to kind of lead right into, you know, Selection Sunday and tournaments and everything like that. Was that kind of a weird, oh, we're playing Harvard today? What?
No, but you know, it wasn't weird until today. When I was looking at the stats and their roster and those guys that are always at the end of the year, I don't even watch them. Like, I don't pay attention to them at this time of year. And you know, I've got the tab open with Harvard's roster and stats and stuff like that. And I'm like, oh, I can file that away now. I don't have to look at these guys. So, you know, as I was saying that before, it's just an Ivy League game and it's, you know, it's a rivalry and everything else, but like every team in our league is a rival at this point. So, the shuffling of the schedule is something that we knew was going to happen years ago. And it's not as weird as my alums seem to think. My alums are a little bit flipping out about it, but they'll get over it.
So of course my cake eater co-host asks exclusively about the offensive end of the field, even though he was a glorified D-Mitty his entire career.
Yeah, watch so, it.
Lord knows what that's all about. I do want to ask you about the defensive end because, you know, it's something that you and I have spoken about a lot over the course of the last few years. You just mentioned your alums. I talked to some of your alums that have referred to something as the TD tax. Somebody who was on this podcast 2 weeks ago, in terms of when you've got TD Erland on your team and he's winning 70-75%, sometimes 80% of the faceoffs, changes the role that you have to play defensively. One of the elements that I've seen with this team this year is Patrick Pisano and what he has brought to the table. Over the last 2 years, it felt like a lot of the times you guys were getting stops, it was because you were getting saves. And so there was a strong difference between was Jared Paquette making clean saves or was he giving up rebounds? And what that meant relative to a combination of your ability to transition and or get easy clears against the riding team. And then also just the role that it played in your efficiency. This year, it feels like you're getting a greater percentage of stops by virtue of a combination of knockdown passes, picked up ground balls on the interior, and everything else. When I was watching that game and Patrick Pisano was guarding the opponent's best player, I was like, man, they're asking him to do a lot. And Sam King went for 5 goals and 3 assists. After the game, you said you felt like he didn't have his best game, but it's partly because you ask him to do a lot. And again, playing defense is a 7-man game. I get it. I'm not like trying, but I guess this is a two-part question. The first part is, what role does he play in terms of bringing you something that maybe you haven't had in the last couple of years? And then also, what does having a player like that do? And I call him a possession ender. What does having a possession ender do to your approach relative to maybe when you have 6 guys who are really good at matching feet or supporting, but they aren't necessarily coming up with the ball on their stick in the way that is as consistent as you would need or want it to be?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you and I have talked about this a million times, either on air or not, but, you know, he definitely is one of those guys who gets the ball off the ground. I think his stats in the first few games were, you know, astronomical for a guy who doesn't play on the wing of the faceoff. So, you know, he's also a really good cover guy. You ask any of our guys last year, they're like, he was the toughest guy to go against in practice. And we didn't feel like we could play him because we felt like he was mentally, he was going to make a, you know, a lot of mistakes. You know, given his youth and, you know, just his kind of style of play. You know, I think that he would admit he didn't have a great game on Saturday. And I think that, you know, going into it, I'm like, listen, this kid's, he's allowed to have a bad game. So, you know, his, you know, matchup on King is, it could have been Mikey Alexander as well. You know, either way, it's either King or Malone. Both of them, you know, great players. So, we feel like we've got a luxury. Those guys can, you know, mix and match on either guy if they want. But, you know, with King having the ball so much, maybe the ball doesn't bop around near a stick as many times as it did in other games. So, you know, but I think he was, you know, he made some mistakes. He had some penalties that were, you know, I think they're going to end up on film tomorrow. We're going to show them that this is what you can't do. You know, he stopped playing at one point after a penalty. It's like, dude, you know the rules? Like, this, you got to keep going here until we get the ball back. So, you know, but he's you know, he's a good kid, and he's going to get better. And we're going to, I think we're going to learn and get, you know, get better as a team in those games. If we can win and still make some of those mistakes, we can iron those out. Hopefully we can get better.
So shifting the focus forward, you've got Cornell coming up next, and they're coming off of a game that we just talked about, a 15-14 win over Princeton, a game that has to give them belief coming off of a bad loss to Penn State, a team that you guys know well as well. You know, this is a Cornell team that you have played a bunch of knockdown dragouts against over the course of the last 3 years with Griffin Busick at the helm, or I'm sorry, Connor Busick at the helm, and then certainly over the course of your entire tenure. What are your thoughts heading into the Big Red?
You know, it's going to be a huge challenge. They're athletic, they're tough, they play hard, and you know, going up there is difficult, and they don't like us, and you know, it's going to be a brawl. It always is. The interesting thing is it's always the first Ivy game, so this is where the shuffle gets, for me, it's like, it's a little strange playing them second, but you know, I think it's going to be, you know, going to be a great game. You know, I think they're a little different this year. I think we're a little different. That game today was crazy. They're up 8-2 and then give up the lead and then have to come back. So that's got to make you better, a game like that. So I think it's going to be, you know, hopefully it's going to be a great game.
Andy Shea, appreciate you joining us on the Tailgate Podcast. So you said that the cabbage failed, but the corned beef was okay?
Well, the corned beef was fine because my wife saved it. But I had to – the crock pot wasn't big enough, so I had to take the corned beef out and then put the cabbage in. And then we had to reshuffle it again, like
this
Ivy League schedule.
Process.
Yeah. She came home and she's like, "This, now it's not cooked." I'm like, I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing. You want me to grill it? Want me to put it on the grill? Make it worse? I could fix it that way.
And final point, Coach. TD says hello. He always wants to be a part of this podcast. He offers to FaceTime in every single time we record, and I actually had to cut him off from those privileges 2 weeks ago.
Good.
But he told me to tell you hello and that he gives you his best and all that corny stuff that TD always says.
Yeah, he got criticized for his lack of quality analysis in your game last week against Denver. Nick, what did TD say when you asked him about Denver Yale?
I don't even remember everything.
He said the refs
says,
suck.
Yeah.
He was like, he said that. He texted that to me. Yeah.
Like, come on, man. We're looking for a little more.
Refs are refs. I know. It was a face-off matchup. Like, you can't. He really doesn't know that much about facing off. I helped him a lot with all that.
Good. And credit to you. Credit to you.
Thank you. Thank you. And now,
awesome.
Now the secret's
Thanks,
out.
Coach.
All right, guys. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Andy.
See ya.
What a nice guy. I haven't really talked to him much. Of all the coaches that, you know, I've met and talked to, I don't think I've met him in person, but it seems like, you know, might be some work in the kitchen, but other than that, seems like a good guy.
I chirped him about his beard yesterday too. It was, He was funny because he was on the podcast in the fall and he had a beard and he usually doesn't. And I was like, what is happening? And not only that, but it also is like pretty white. And so there's like a Santa Claus element to it as well. And if you've ever been around him, he's like the grumpy elf, not the like jolly Santa Claus. Yeah. And so as a result, like the white beard has like a little bit more of a sinister vibe, which I think is probably what he's going for. I didn't expect it to be an in-season addition, however, and that's why when you walked up yesterday, I was like, what is happening? You're letting people in public see you like this? It's crazy.
It's like the Santa Claus clone in the Tim Allen movie where it's like, hey, correct. Hey, wait a second, something's off here. Either way, thank you to Coach Shea, and really thank you for chirping TD there at the end. I am going to use that as ammunition for the foreseeable future. Okay, moving on. We have our first non-Ivy League game.
It was a big one. It was the biggest game of the weekend.
It was the biggest game of the weekend.
And we're talking about it 45 minutes in the podcast. That's what you call quality production.
Anybody has problems, go yell at the mirror. Go yell into the void. I ain't listening. We're still crushing it. But actually, please give us feedback. Virginia, Maryland, the Hoos and the Terps. So Virginia comes away with a 14-10 victory. Good game, but honestly, given the scope of all the other games and how they played out, I'll say that this was the most boring game of the weekend. UVA ended a 3-game losing streak to the Terps. And, you know, again, it was a pretty cut and dry. UVA kept and maintained a lead for the entire duration of the game. So the story, though, was Griffin Schutz with a six-point day, 4 goals and 2 assists. Virginia started off by jumping out to a 6-2 lead, which was in danger at some point throughout the game, but Maryland never led and Virginia never really looked back. What I thought was interesting about this in the write-up, Nick Redd, who plays for Maryland, he said, and I quote, "Virginia's a great team and they have a great system, but what makes them so good is they have great pieces, and I feel like that's what makes the two-man game go." And that's what I think is separating Virginia from a lot of other teams this year. Not only does Lars Tiffany implement those X's and O's, but the skill level and quality of the players that they have, top to bottom, again, kind of going back to that depth well, they just have playmakers and guys that can put up points scattered across the roster, and they can implement them in many different ways at any situation throughout the game, and they make them, I would say, probably the most feared offense to scout against as far as the weaponry that is being that you have to prepare for. Good systems, but great players. Combine that with what was almost like a weird, like, you don't expect Maryland to make transition errors and, you know, some kind of weird, dumb mistakes, but they did that with relative consistency throughout the game, which allowed them, which allowed Virginia to ultimately come away with a win.
So I wanted to interrupt you when you were halfway through that point. Because
try me.
One of the things that is so poignant about what you said is their power versus speed dynamic when Schutz is playing well is just the most dramatically different that any team offers, right? So you have Griffin Schutz, who's probably like the second most powerful skilled dodger in the game behind Peyton Cormier. And then you have Connor Schellenberger, who, like, I'm not saying he would win a sprint with everybody else in college lacrosse, but I have probably said that over the course of his career in Charlottesville. And then McCabe Millen, who, when McCabe Millen played at Midnight Mania, which is our event that we've hosted a few times, where it's an individual event, 88 players, 12 or 15 college coaches. John Tillman has coached in it before. Lars has coached, Kevin Cassis has coached, Sean Kerwin has coached it.
Sick brag.
Well, listen, I do so little. Now, granted, you do less self-promotion to Second Slide than I do of Inside the Cross on this podcast, but like we both do, like we deliver a very advertising-free podcast for these listeners. So let me indulge myself. I say sick brag
only because I'm mad that I haven't been invited to either broadcast or do media at the Midnight Mania.
I invited you to coach an event this summer, and you're like, I'm not coming to Baltimore in the summer. I'm going to be in Boise, which, by the way, is the right choice. That was true before 36 guys showing up to play sixes on a random Sunday
and
afternoon.
And that's not Midnight Mania. That's some 115-degree turf field in Baltimore. I want Midnight Mania continue.
All right, we'll get you to Midnight Mania. So when McCabe was there, He did something that was exactly the same as what Andrew McAdory did the year before. It was this incredible box-to-box transition lead where it was like... I guess the better comparison for the kids now is in the Fast movies when you press the NOS. But the way I think about it is when you shift from sixth gear to fifth, right? So if you've ever driven a six-speed and you're like in like mid-RPM range going like 100 miles an hour or so, and like for whatever reason you need to be going 120 very, very fast, you'd shift down to fifth gear and accelerate. That is what those guys did. And I was standing next to Andy when he did that, and he's like, he's the fastest lacrosse player I've ever seen. It was, and I'm probably in like breaking the like, you know, cone of silence or whatever. He was just on the podcast, so he can deal with it. So you've got Millen and Schellenberger, who are incredibly fast, and then you've got Schuss and Cormier, who are incredibly powerful. Yes, it is very hard to prepare for and match up with those guys, especially when you're making the mistakes that you just talked about Maryland making. But even still, like, it's tough because I am positive that John Tillman is focused on those mistakes when it comes to evaluating, talking to his team about the things that they need to do better, because those are the controllables, right? But when you take a step back and you look at Maryland as a national championship contender, it's hard not to consider them from the standpoint of the uncontrollables. And now we have a two-game sample of Braden Erksa being covered by an elite defenseman and being limited. And the question about this Maryland offense has been, what are they from the alpha standpoint? And my argument or contention has been their ability to move the ball and what Eric Molliver brings them relative to who they were last year. And when you have the umbrella of the four shooters surrounding Erksa and Molliver, that's a potent offense. But they were only able to put up 10 against Virginia. I am sure that John Tillman is going to point out the missed opportunities to put themselves in the position offensively to score goals and say, we are good enough to beat this team. But if you're an outside observer and you're looking at this as a potential national championship matchup, I think it's pretty clear that Virginia is a lot better than Maryland right now.
I couldn't agree more. And even in that, like, you chalk up the mistakes that Maryland made. Even if they tighten that up, I still just think that Virginia separated themselves from Maryland today. I'm going to be very interested because Maryland now has two ACC losses as they head into Big Ten play. I am going to be very curious how Maryland advances through their conference schedule. And it's going to be really fun to, I don't know. I love the preseason non-conference because it just sets up, and it sets the tone for, like, how good are these teams heading into conference play? How good is Maryland? But also, conversely, how good are Notre Dame and Virginia having had both relatively, I don't want to say decisive, but good wins over Maryland? It wasn't like, you know, an OT fluke. So, not much more to say on that. Now, here's an interesting game. This is the upset of the week. And for the record, Terry, I wanted to start off with this, but you actually made a good point, and I hate to give you credit that this game is now going to be 4 days old at the time of listening to this. But Navy goes into Johns Hopkins and wins 10-9 in overtime. America's Patriots game of the week, and Navy, who's now 4-3 with losses to Lehigh and Penn State and Towson, all pretty lopsided losses, comes away with a doozy. This one shocked me. It kind of blew me away. I logged on to Twitter and everybody was going nuts, and I was like, I gotta tune into this game. Max Hewitt scored the game-winning goal on a reviewed crease goal for their first win at Hopkins since 1969. And I love military academy sports stats. I saw that Army's off to their best start since 84. Navy gets their first win at Homewood since 69. There's always like that long history that comes with it. It was a great 5-goal comeback, capped by that goal by Hewitt, but it was really led by Dane Swanson, who upgraded his flintlock pistol to a military-grade sniper this past weekend and had a hat trick on the day. And there are two fascinating storylines here. One is, as far as you mentioned the Cornell, they had the best return flight of the week. Navy pretty clearly won the worst trip out there of all time.
And potentially the worst trip home because they might have had to walk.
Yeah, I mean, So for those that are unaware, the bus rides, Navy's first bus got into an accident. Their second bus broke down, and on a trip that they probably could have rucked to, it probably would have taken them a couple hours to just walk there. They ended up showing up an hour and a half late. In contrast to Hopkins, who's now on spring break, doesn't have classes. They were just sitting there playing fiddlesticks. And we have to talk about the ice pick, which we'll talk about at the end. But first, in-game analysis, what do you got?
So, I've said on this podcast multiple times already this season that Hopkins' lack of offensive continuity is puzzling to me. And I've attributed it to the fact that they are trying to break in 12, 13 guys, and that there is a growth curve that's a part of that, that has an expense on the front end and a benefit on the back end. One of the potential benefits is that when somebody like Brooks English goes down for with a season-ending injury, then you have more behind him that's prepared to pick up the load and walk forward. But that's not, I can't say that anymore, because this team scored at like a 50 to 60% clip against Syracuse. They just didn't have the ball enough a week ago. So I can't use that as the reason that they were as unproductive against Navy as they were, especially when they jumped out to a 6-1 lead. So what I come back to is a combination of how much credit to give Navy, and especially, like, I am such a huge believer in whenever you face the type of adversity that puts you in a situation where you can't help but react, meaning, like, your opportunity to think and overanalyze is taken away from you. So, like, for instance, your bus shows up an hour and a half late, and as a result, like, you don't get to go through your normal warm-up. You just have to go through, like, your panicked, like, frantic, whatever, and then go out and play. I am a huge believer that that is more often beneficial than it is detrimental. Now, you can certainly say, like, well, they fell behind 6-1. It was clearly detrimental. I can't prove that that's an incorrect take. But my opinion is that that long-tail benefit is how they were able to overcome that 5-goal deficit and then get the game back to even with Zach Tyashi's goal off the faceoff win to start the second half. And I think that it's tough because I watched Navy early in the season and this is going to sound harsh, but was thoroughly unimpressed. And the fact that they looked as good performance-wise as they did against Hopkins is a testament to the progress. It's a testament to how much better they have gotten over as the season's gone along. I've watched them more recently, and I've been more impressed with their performances, even when they were losing, right? So they beat BU, good performance, great result. But they kind of have BU's number, and they kind of have the matchup advantage in a lot of different spots on the field, right? Then they turn around and lose to Lehigh. I really wanted to watch that game because I was very curious as to whether or not Army was on upset alert against Lehigh. And, you know, I was like, this Navy team looks better than they did against Hofstra and Mount St. Mary. So here we are. What type of credit to give Navy? What type of demerit to give Hopkins? And I just come back to it. And I'm like, the defense played well enough to win. The special teams didn't necessarily, like, bail you out. But at the same time, like, they lost because of their offensive performance. And I can't blame that they're running a third midfield excuse or reason the way I did early in the year, because it clearly wasn't a problem against Syracuse. So I'm a little bit at a loss, frankly. Like, I don't want to throw this result out as an outlier, because now, you know, I would do that against I would explain away Hopkins Denver loss as that was so unlikely. The way that game ended is just not repeatable. Okay. And then you can explain away the Syracuse loss, where it's like they just didn't have the ball. They couldn't win faceoffs and they couldn't clear. You can't explain away three losses. There is a problem. It's systemic. It needs to be fixed. This is a good, talented team with a lot of experience that made it to the quarterfinals last year. We declared them back on the basis of the fact that they could actually contend for a Final Four, right? And they still can. That is right there in front of them. I mean, their RPI is like 6. They even in the wake of a Navy loss, it's not as if their season is over. It's just they have to go back to the drawing board and figure out how they're going to be better in order to beat the likes of Rutgers, who's coming off of a win over UMass, and Penn State, who's very good, and Maryland, who's very good, and Michigan and Ohio State. right? And that is what sits in front of them now.
Well, and it's in stark contrast to who we just had on, Andy Shea, whose roster is completely decimated and is finding a way to scrape together great wins. You know, it's like you can't give credit and then immediately come back and, you know, mousetrap yourself with saying, oh, well, you can just chalk it up to these problems that we see Yale succeed with and Hopkins start to fail with. So what I do wish, though, and I have no idea.
Well, hold on. Real quick, time out. Hopkins' win over Virginia is still the best win we've seen so far this season, right?
I mean, Notre Dame handled Michigan this weekend, but yeah, I would say that yes, that's probably the best win. But RPI is stupid, and a loss over Navy negates that Virginia win in my idiot brain.
Yeah, it doesn't though. So we have Army, who's undefeated, number one. We have Notre Dame, who's number two, who lost at home against Georgetown. Hopkins beat Georgetown. Not saying that totally negates the win, but when you consider that relative to Virginia, in my opinion, is very clearly number three, and in reality. I'm not saying this. People are saying this.
Many people.
Maybe Army is not actually the best team.
Wow.
Right? Maybe they belong like fourth or fifth in the rankings. But they're the most deserving team, and that's why they're number one. Right? We support the troops. And in that scenario, either Notre Dame or Virginia is number one. Right? They both have a home loss against a team that they should have beaten. But if they are 1-2... then the tiebreaker would be, and the two teams that beat each of them, then the tiebreaker would be the team that beat the team that beat the team. Then in that scenario, I think it's still true that Hopkins' win at Virginia is the best win on the board so far this season.
Well, you also have to take into account their fan base, which I think puts them at 11. Just from
also,
the
they didn't have Anthony Gabriel in that game, so it's a huge mitigating factor in terms of why.
What I do wish, though, the point that I was going to make is at some point, either it was Amplo or another coach or a Navy player, they probably gave the most bone-chilling badass speech that we will see this season about, we don't care if the buses break down. We don't care if we're down 6-1. We still got this game. And I hope that the speech that I'm envisioning is actually, close
Dave Cottle delivering it?
Well, maybe Dave Cottle. I would like to think that it's some guy who's going to be in Buds this time next year. As much as I love Cottle, I feel like...
You've been on the receiving end of Dave Cottle motivational speeches. Can you imagine a scenario in which he would have channeled the bus accident / bursting into flames breakdown?
Oh, I'm ready to run through a wall right now. I'll do it. I'll go beat Hopkins by myself for the first time since 69, Terry.
I'm more interested in whether or not Dave Cottle would be more insulted by the Boise State or Boise lacrosse player who didn't know. By the way, was the at Mountain View Park, is the turf turf blue?
No, turf is not blue. The Coors Lights were blue, which was a big factor in, I think, a lot of guys' games. But to wrap up this Hopkins-Navy game, I do have a take, and the big viral moment was, I'm not even going to say players' names because I think he's already gotten enough hate. The classic wing, you're lining up, getting ready to run in the face-off. Hopkins player, whether it was intentional or not, which it for sure was, I've done this about 100 times in my life, you just start running, and then all of a sudden, the butt end of your stick hits the other player in the groin / crotch region, which certainly doesn't feel good. I have experience in this, Terry, as you were talking about earlier in the podcast. For those that are unaware, during the San Diego Seal season 3 years ago, I ruptured my testicle and finished practice after getting hit with a shot by Connor Kelly. Does that make me a hero and tough? Many people are saying yes. So the scumbagginess of the play is up for debate because this happens probably once a game, and whether it makes direct contact or it's attempted, it's going to happen. I've done this many times in my career. What I gotta say, though, Navy player kind of sold it. I've been hit harder than just about anybody else, and I still finish practice. So credit to the Navy player for flopping around like he just got, hit by something harder than a weak butt end of the stick coming off of the face-off wing. That was the take that I wanted to say, and I think hopefully if you're listening to this, you have a reaction to that. Try me, because I'll die on this hill that, yeah, getting hit in the nuts sucks. You don't have to act like that, but good sell to generate the motivation that probably led Navy to a win. How dare Hopkins does this? And it wasn't a penalty. Went completely unnoticed, and Ampla was going nuts at the referee. And I thought, what a great no call by the ref to give Navy that motivation, because the guy who is, you know, was writhing on the ground probably came back and said, who do these Hopkins players think they are? I just got hit in the cojones, and now we're going to go and take this victory. I think that play might have actually given Navy the edge.
I don't disagree with that at all. I think that is very real. I do have to admit a confession, which is I'm a little disappointed, because I thought that what you were teasing at the beginning of the podcast was that when you offered your, if you are listening to this, individual who got hit in the groin with a shot, this was a Hopkins Loyola photo, credit Craig McNulty, who we didn't shout out at the time because I didn't know whether or not I was allowed to say, Alex Bean is the Loyola lacrosse player. And you volunteered your services. You're like, hey man, if you need counseling, I thought that he had actually finally reached out to you. That was what I thought you were teasing. And so that was the story that I thought we were going to get.
And, but, I'll put carte blanche, which,
yeah,
what a great.
Any lacrosse player who sustains.
Any lacrosse player.
An injury north of the knee and south of the hip.
South
Nick
of the
Acello
belly
is
button.
Your guy. His DMs are open.
Hit me up. I'll walk you through the entire process. But what a great win by Navy. And as what is becoming a semi-tradition on this podcast, I'm going to hit you with a couple sampler platters that you get a pick from. So the choose your own adventure begins now. Pour one out. NJIT lost their first game as Vermont is now public enemy number one after their head coach Charles Cornwallis put together a great game plan. I hope people understand that reference. Notre Dame had a bye weekend versus Michigan, won infinity to zero. Quinnipiac's undefeated, which is kind of flying under the radar. And then Tom Schreiber gave a speech to Merrimack as they snapped a 5-game loss streak versus Binghamton in overtime. Of those 4 games, where do you want this direction to go, Terry?
So I think, again, I like to respond just gut to these questions. And I got to say, I was impressed by NJIT only losing by 3 to Vermont, right? You know, obviously Vermont lost by a goal at midweek to Dartmouth. That probably refocused them relative to... You could have imagined them being high on their horse, which is a term that we've used a lot the last couple weeks, so I apologize for the repetitiveness, after beating UMass the week prior. That being said, I look at a 12-9 final, and I say, and let's be clear. Patrick McEwen made the point on Twitter. He got called whatever terms he got called for
as
being
Patrick
like a party
McEwen
pooper.
Does. Yeah.
It's why he does it. It's what he lives for. But his point was, if you look at NJIT on the basis of the quality of the wins they got in developing their, I believe it was 7-0, right? They got to 7-0. It means that they're incredibly improved year over year and that they are a great story. It does not mean that they are a top 20 team. Justified, right? Like totally justified. Stand on a bold point. The question is, there is a wide gap between 21 and like 45. It is possible that NJIT could have put together a 7-0 start against, there are 74 teams, I think, this year, 75. I can't keep it straight between Hartford and Lynnwood and Iona, who's in and who's out.
Yeah, close enough.
It's somewhere in the neighborhood of 74 to 76. It is theoretically possible to be 7-0 and the 65th best team in Division I.
Hey,
right?
Be nice.
I'm not saying that that's what NJIT is. I'm saying that it is possible to be that. I think that, so UMass is like very clearly a borderline top 20 team. Vermont beat them last week. NJIT like gave a very, very real game to Vermont, right? Like my point is that I don't know where NJIT actually is, but they're like definitely in that 35 to 55 morass. This was the second or third worst team in college lacrosse for 10 years. Like the amount of improvement that is demonstrated in 1.5 seasons to go from the third worst team to somewhere between the 35th and 55th is enormous. And we had Eric Wolf on this podcast a few weeks ago. And this is just, for me, this loss provides more validation than probably 6 of their wins so far this year. So, and not only that, I do have to shout out Merrimack and their overtime win over Binghamton. That was really impressive. I watched the end of the game. It was a really exciting game.
Another, hey, Merrimack was up, I think, 6-0. Classic overtime game. And to your point, too, people only care about the top 20, seemingly. That's the only discussion that's on social media. And they're like, oh, rank them. Hey, shut up. And I think that that's a great point that I just want to echo. I think NJIT far and away most improved to go from, you know, 57th to, you know, 30th, we'll call it. Name another team that's jumped that much. So even while their perfect season has been they lost their perfect season. America's team, Coach Wolf, the people's coach. I've been more impressed with his interview than any other interview that we've done on this podcast. I still want to make sure that we're giving them the amount of credit. Chase
just cries into his pillow.
Chase, why don't you go cry and then say, hey, TD, Nick was being mean on a podcast. But overall, what a weekend of lacrosse. Good, tight games top to bottom. Ivy League giving us the fireworks that we needed. Navy Hopkins, I mean, this weekend was a fantastic weekend to be a lacrosse fan. And not all of the weekends are. Some of them, yeah, oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah, you remember how bad that second weekend was this year? Week one, get out of here.
And I was texting you, and I'm like, I always make the joke, oh, what are we going to talk about? And that one I was like, but like, what are we going
to
talk about?
Yeah, like legitimately, which 8-goal win do you want to talk about?
Yeah, so credit to all the teams giving us all the stuff to talk about.
Specifically here. Matt Dooley.
Specifically Matt Dooley. At a kid. Keep it up. Keep up the good work.
I've got to give a shout out to Patrick Reed. He might be our number one fan. He's listening to this right now. It's probably about, what do we got? It's probably 6:10 a.m. He just finished walking his dogs. Nick, it is very fun to encounter listeners in the wild, especially when they don't ask you about testicular issues.
That's what I hope for.
Yeah. It's not what I hope for.
Ask me about my cojones, please.
Next week we will be back with the Cajones Dodger of the week.
Yeah, we'll make a stat for it, and I'll put together a Canva graphic so we can make it a weekly bit.
As always, if you like what you heard, leave a rating and review. I am Terry Foy, he is Nick Osello. This was a very fun one, and we'll be back later in the week with more Inside the Cross podcast. I'm sure Dan Kaplan's going to have a full Mustang Kaplan. That's what they should rename it. They should rename it the Mustang Kaplan because nobody else is there for all 10 games except for Paul Canopy. The Mustang Classic Recap. And it's unbelievable, dude. Mustang Classic Recap is apparently quite the tongue twister. And we'll be back next week with another episode of the Tailgate Podcast. It probably won't be as good as this one, so hope you liked it.
I love you, Terry.
Love you, Nick.